Good morning and welcome to episode 31 of our monthly Meet the Experts Q&A session with Cinten's employment team. I'm David Pritchard, Head of Marketing at Cinten's. Just wanted to say we're 31 episodes in and we just were talking before we started recording this morning, Friday morning. Just wanted to thank you once again for all your positive comments about these sessions, for continuing to sign up for them. We have a record number of people that are tuning in this morning. We just want to thank you for sending in your questions, for watching the video afterwards, engaging on social media, listening to the podcast version. We are staggered with the amount of people that are still interested in these sessions, so we thank you for that. Just moving the slides on quickly there. Our speakers are in front of you. We have Partner and Head of Employment Keith Land and Associate Catherine Hope. As with previous months, our speakers will be answering three questions. So without any further ado, I'm going to pass you straight over to Catherine. Catherine is going to do question one. Catherine, good morning and over to you.
Thanks, David. Good morning. Good morning, everyone, and thanks for joining us again this week. So we've got a few questions again as normal. The first one is in relation to an employee who's tested positive for COVID and you're requiring them to stay at home. What are they entitled to in terms of pay, even though they might, for example, be fit to work or they may no longer be testing positive? I think in the context of this question, it's important to note the changes that came in relation to SSP, which came in spring 2020 at the start of the pandemic, have come to an end yesterday. And as far as we are aware, there aren't any plans or confirmation as to the extension of that. So that's in relation to, for example, SSP being available from day one in relation to COVID-related absences. So it's important just to have that in mind in relation to this particular situation. So just going back to the question, obviously, if someone can work from home, then they are carrying out their job and they should be paid as normal. If they're unable to, then the starting point, as is always generally the case, you need to look at the contract, terms of the contract of employment, but also if there are any policies that have contractual status, looking to see whether there is any entitlement in those in relation to pay, company sick pay in these kind of situations. I think it would be unusual to find something that clearly covers this situation, but it's always important, obviously, to check in the first instance. It may well be that they give something, give an entitlement for the employer to send an employee home in this kind of situation without pay. Again, I think that would be unusual, but it's just worth checking. I think alongside that, you need to be aware of the common law principle that if an employee is ready, willing and able to work, they are entitled to, the general principle is that they are entitled to pay unless there's anything in the contract that states otherwise. I guess from an employer's perspective, you could say, well, actually, we don't think they are because of the risk they pose to others. But on the flip side, I think that doesn't necessarily affect their ability to carry out their role. And that is, I guess, it's the determination of you as the employer having followed and carried out a risk assessment. So I think it's something you could decide to do, but I think you just have to be prepared for the fact that there is a risk. This particular situation itself hasn't been tested and we may well see cases come across in the next year, given now certainly that you know the regulations of or the requirement to self-isolate has gone. There was a case going back to 2019, a Court of Appeal case, Greg, and the employer there was Northwest Anglia NHS Foundation Trust. And in that, in the summing up, the Court of Appeal gave a number of situations where it could amount to an unlawful deduction of wage. And one of those was that if an employee is willing and able to work, but the prevention of them coming to the workplace is due to the results of a third party decision, then the deduction may well be unlawful. So it's important to bear that in mind. So it could be the case that if someone's inability to actually come to the workplace is involuntary and it's as a result of a policy you've presented, there could be a risk. It's difficult because I'm not sure how far that principle would go, and this hasn't been tested. And it was a particular situation that was connected to suspension. So I think it's bearing that in mind. And interestingly, Greg was applied in a case going back to 2020 in relation to the pandemic. That was Jones versus Conduit Construction. And in that case, an employee was sent home having car shared with a colleague who then had COVID-19 symptoms, and they were sent home without pay. And that was found to be unlawful deduction of wages. Now, obviously, that is a first instance decision, so it's not binding. and things have changed. It was obviously a different situation as to it is now, but I think it's just worth bearing in mind. Interestingly, in that case, the tribunal pointed out that they considered the health and safety concerns that the employer had to take into account and the duty of care to other employees. And they welcomed and they made the point that, yes, there's careful consideration there for other, you know, the welfare of the wider workforce, but it doesn't then translate automatically to then the ability to not pay the employee for then not wanting to come into the workplace. So just some interesting points there to consider. I think it's something that can be done, but you always have to just bear in mind that there is a risk there because this particular circumstance hasn't been tested. I guess regardless of what the legal position is from an HR perspective, just in terms of HR relations with your staff, but also if you are particularly concerned about the risks within the workforce and its spreading and the disruption that could cause, having a policy whereby staff aren't paid their full pay if you're requiring them to stay at home could backfire in that regard, because it may well be that they're more likely not to tell you if they've tested positive, for example, if they've had contact with someone. And I guess this may become less relevant because we're going to have less and less testing as, you know, access to free tests is removed. But it's just something to bear in mind, depending on what you're actually looking for in terms of an outcome. So that's that first question. I'll pass you over to Keith for the second question.
Thanks, Catherine. It's a while since I've been on here because the team has been doing them so well, they've completely cut me out of the loop. My question is not related to COVID, which is a strange thing because we've done so much on COVID. Can an employer force an employee to tell them who their new employer is going to be after they've resigned? I could do this very, very quickly in a nutshell and probably just say no, and that would be the answer, but that's probably not giving you much in the way of guidance, is it? I think the answer really depends on whether there is an express contractual obligation on the employee to disclose this information to their employer. Some restrictive covenant clauses that are expressly written in the contracts indicate that an employee who resigns must notify their employer, their current employer, of any approaches or job offers made to them by any other business which competes with them. Now, the then question is, what is the position if the employee doesn't do that? Those kind of clauses are not necessarily a restraint of trade in themselves, because they're not a block on the employee moving on to another employer and working, in a sense. They're just saying, if you get another job, you have to let us know who that is, so we can make so we as your current employer can make an assessment as to whether that is going to infringe the other covenants. So what happens if the employee just doesn't? They refuse to give the information and they move on. Well, I suppose on face value, it is a breach of an express term of the contract. The employee's resigned. Could it be a position for disciplinary action for failure to follow a reasonable and lawful instruction? Possibly. But whether it's going to justify the summary dismissal anyway, because the problem here is that the employee goes on to another employer and breaches the post-termination restrictions in any event, which at the point in time of them refusing to tell the person or tell an employer of the identity of their new prospective employer, they haven't really done much wrong. So the remedy available to the employer, the current employer that is, for their employee not telling them to who their new employer is going to be, is probably going to be just damages and breach of contract. I don't think that anyone would ever get an injunction to stop the employer moving on, because there's no technical restraint to a breach of a restrictive covenant at that point in time. And I would question, even if you have one of those clauses, what the loss would be and how any court would quantify it. So employee resigns, they don't tell the employer sues them for breach of contract. What have they lost? Well, they've lost a piece of information that says that employee might prospectively move on to another employer, which is a competing business. Well, they're going to find out that information in the long term anyway, and then they're going to be able to rely on post-termination restrictions if they are enforceable in any event. So I find it difficult to see that how a delay in discovering the identity of a new employer of one of your employees is going to entitle you to a wedge of compensation. And if there's no really meaningful losses, what's the point of you wasting your time and cost trying to enforce those kind of provisions? That said, I suppose what's therefore the benefit of having it? I would say that probably it does have some persuasive impact on an employee. If also you have an employee that does move on to another employer and they breach the terms of those post-termination restrictions and you have to take action in connection with those restrictions, it is then another clause in the contract to point to say, well, this employee is just dishonest, they're dodgy, look what they've done. Is just another example of a contractual clause that they have trampled all over. Probably better having it than not. What if there's no express contractual provision? Well, I find it very hard to say that there would ever be an implied obligation on an employee to disclose who their new employer would be. So I don't really think you're going to have much in the way of redress. In every contract of employment, there is the implied duty of fidelity. That is things like an employee will not make a secret profit. They won't divert profits away from their employer. I cannot see how that in any way would extend to create an implied obligation for an employee to tell their employer who they're moving on to work for after they've left employment. Some employees are of a sufficiently senior position that they have fiduciary obligations. That means that they have a special obligation to not damage the interests of their employer. A manager of a team of people, for example, might have fiduciary obligations. There is an argument to say that those people should report their own wrongdoing. And insofar as they are moving on to an employer, and that's a potential breach of a restrictive covenant, should they raise that fact with their employee. However, if they're acting within the terms of the contract, they resign. And in this instance, I'm looking where there's no express contractual clause, of course, that says you have to notify your employer. Somebody would have to present an argument that it's within somebody's fiduciary obligations when they resign to tell their employer who they're moving on to. I find that very hard to see when the employee has resigned, given due contractual notice, and is moving on to another employer as they're entitled to do. There are always arguments about enforceability of covenants. So if there's no express contractual obligation, I think you're not really going to have a leg to stand on. I think I've done that to death. I don't know, Catherine, if you have any further observations you want to make before moving on to the third question.
Thanks, Keith. No, I think you covered that in a lot of detail. It's going to be looking at the contract, as you said, and what's there, if there are any contractual obligations to look at, and the practical impact on the company involved. It's not really something that comes up in practice a lot, so it's an interesting one for us to look at this week. The third and final question is in relation to annual leave and sick leave. And the question here is whether you can require an employee to use up their annual leave whilst they're carrying out a phased return from sick leave. I mean, the answer to the question, it really depends on the type of leave, which I'll look at, but there are some overall considerations to make as well, which I'll come on to. When someone is in a phased return, returning from sick leave, they are in effect on sick leave, but also working, whether that be on, you know, working certain hours during the week or just reduced hours each day. With a number of things in employment, you need to look at the statutory perspective and then the contractual perspective. From a statutory perspective, we're looking at holiday entitlement, which derives from the Working Time Directive, which is the 4 weeks from EU law, and also then the additional 1.6 weeks that we have under the Working Time Regulations. Under the Working Time Regulations, it does allow employers to give notice to employees to take the statutory leave at certain points in the year. So you would think that that would enable them to then require employees to take that statutory leave whilst they're on a phased return. But we need to be mindful of, there have been some European Court of Justice cases, and those ones I'm talking about are Pareda and Anged, and Pareda looked at sickness leave and pre-scheduled holiday and rearranging that, and Anged looked at the requirement, the ability to be able to postpone holiday, which was because of sick leave. And really, they make it very clear that it's contrary to the Working Time Directive to force a worker who's on sick leave to take statutory leave against their wishes. And that is obviously in relation to the 4 weeks that derives from the Working Time Directive. So although employees are in a position where they can take holiday whilst on sick leave, that's not something you can compel them to do for that statutory leave. It's then really important to look at a contractual perspective, because you, if you are an employer who gives your employees enhanced holiday entitlement, in terms of that enhanced element, you will have some more discretion in terms of what you're able to do in that regard. What I would say is you do need to be careful, though, in terms of potential disability discrimination. If the employee in question has a disability and they're off because of that, and they're on a phased return because of their disability, then you run the risk of running into, you know, that amounting to disability discrimination. For example, discrimination arising in consequence of something arising out of that disability. For example, if you're treating them unfavourably because of a consequence of their disability, i.e. that they're on sick leave and they're having to carry out that phased return, you run the risk of exposing yourself to potential claims there. I guess, although less likely, an employee could run the argument that you're in breach of the implied term of mutual trust and confidence and resign and claim constructive dismissal, but I think the likelihood of that happening in practice would be rare. So it depends on the type of holiday. You do need to bear in mind the particular situation and circumstances that you're dealing with. Just out of interest, if you're looking at a lot of these things come up because at the moment statutory sick pay can't be paid during a phased return. Interestingly, there was a consultation back in 2019 from the Department for Work and Pensions and the Department for Health and Social Care, and the consultation put forward a number of proposals in relation to statutory sick pay, including the ability to pay that during the phased return. However, and the main issue was the pandemic, but they did confirm last year that they're not going to be taking those forward at the moment. But it's just interesting that is obviously something that has come up in the past. That's us in terms of the questions, but I don't know if you've got anything else, Keith, that you want to touch upon.
Yes, I do actually briefly. I think that area that you've touched on is really complex. Different chunks of holiday, different rights applying to it. The best advice is, if you're faced with that situation, to really get some advice on it, because it is horrendously complex, because you've got quite a directive leave, leave in the UK, and then contractual leave, and never the twain shall meet. But I thought it would be remiss of us to let this situation go past without commenting on P&O Ferries. Don't worry, I'm not going to pummel them, because I don't actually know what's gone on within that business, but it is all over the news. And there's probably a few of you asking the question that says, well, how can you let 800 people go without doing collective consultation, which is required by the law? I think everyone's scratching their head anyway, and it will come out in due course. But ultimately, for those that have raised an eyebrow as to what's happened, ultimately the law does specify that if you are dismissing 20 or more employees in 90 days or less, there should be a period of collective consultation prior to the first dismissal taking effect. And the dismissal taking effect in that respect is an employer giving notice of termination under the contract. That clearly didn't happen in the P&O case. They've let approximately 800 employees go, which meant that there should have been, in theory, a 45-day period of consultation prior to the first dismissal taking effect. The reality is that legislation exists, and it has some really hefty teeth to it, that if you breach the legislation, an employer can face what we call a protective award, which is a payment that is made to those employees that are claiming, which is equivalent to 90 days gross pay at its maximum. So if you get it wrong, in effect, it is a quarter of your wage bill, really, if you want to view it in those terms. Now, in this instance, P&O has let those people go, and then they're trying to put in place a different business model. Clearly, there will be a potential claim for failure to inform and consult that exists for those 800 workers. I can only assume, because fundamentally none of us really know, do we? It will come out in due course, I think, as the thing almost certainly, I imagine, will litigate, that there has been a commercial decision made. The business has put out there that it is losing masses of money, and I mean millions on millions every month. And consequently, they must have weighed up the commercial cost of the liability, the potential to start, I suppose, consultation, and if they then can't cut it short, because the only way you can cut that consultation short is by agreement with the employee representatives, which in this instance would be the union, that they've decided that it is too commercially damaging, their ongoing operations, and they can't continue to trade throughout that. So they've had to let the people go and take the commercial potential liability on the chin, on the hope that they can sweep that up in due course. We will have to see. I think part of that will be the cost of the business of continuing to operate versus the cost of the payouts. It may be that they can offer the people back their jobs under different guises, so they are mitigating their losses in that respect. I think also you've got to look at the nature of the business. They're operating ferries across the channel. There are only a limited number of people to do that. And despite this being a PR disaster, I suppose, for them in the short term, what alternatives do they have? I suppose the board of directors will know that and we won't. But it's not like another business where somebody can really dive all over their market share. How could you jump into their roots and their without having massive capital costs to have a number of ships that allow you to do it? I think all of that will have factored into their considerations. There it is. I thought I'd give you my 5 minutes of thoughts on that. I think it sounds like a huge commercial decision. We will see what happens in due course, but I imagine litigation will follow. But I assume that the board of directors knew that when they entered into that course of action. Many thanks for listening. I'm going to pass you back to David, who's going to wrap up.
Thanks very much to both of you. Reminder for me, as usual, at this point, we are continuing to work hard to produce and deliver useful and relevant content, articles, blogs, podcasts, videos, all of which can be found on our website, www.sintons.co.uk, should you wish to take a look. And that includes all episodes of this Q&A series. And you can also follow the employment team on Twitter at SintonsHR, should you wish to do so. I've popped our speakers' details back on the screen. If you'd like to discuss anything they've raised today further in this or any of the other sessions, please don't hesitate to get in touch. Our next session will be Friday, the 29th of April. Can't believe we're going to be in April this quickly, 2022, at 10 a.m. on Teams. And as usual, I'll send the link round about a week before. All that's left to say is thank you once again for listening. We don't take it for granted. Stay safe, everyone. And we'll speak to you next time. Thank you.